Ma used to soak wounds in salt water and pack them with mud mixed with all kinds of potions. There was no salt in the kitchen. So Kaya limped into the woods toward a brackish slipstream so salty at low tide, its edges glistened with brilliant white crystals. She sat on the ground, soaking her foot in the marsh's brine, all the while moving her mouth. Open, close, mocking yawns, chewing motions, anything to keep it from jamming up. After nearly an hour, the tide receded enough for her to dig a hole in the black mud with her fingers, and she eased her foot gently into the silky earth. The air was cool here, and eagle cries gave her bearing. By late afternoon, she was very hungry, so went back to the shack. Pa's room was still empty, and he probably wouldn't be home for hours. Playing poker and drinking whiskey kept a man busy most of the night. There were no grits, but rummaging around, she found an old greasy tin of Crisco shortening, dipped up a tiny bit of the white fat and spread it on a soda cracker, nibbled at first, then ate five more. She eased into her porch bed, listening for Pa's boat. The approaching night tore and darted and sleep came in bits, but she must have dropped off near morning, for she woke with the sun fully on her face. Quickly, she opened her mouth. It still worked. She shuffled back and forth from the brackish pool to the shack until, by tracking the sun, she knew 2 days had passed. She opened and closed her mouth. Maybe she had made it. That night, tucking herself into the sheets of the floor mattress, her mud-caked foot wrapped in a rag, she wondered if she would wake up dead. No, she remembered. It wouldn't be that easy. Her back would bow, her limbs twist. A few minutes later, she felt a twinge in her lower back and sat up. Oh, no. Oh, no. Ma. Ma. The sensation in her back repeated itself and made her hush.
It's just an itch, she muttered.
Finally, truly exhausted, she slept, not opening her eyes until doves murmured in the oak. She walked to the pool twice a day for a week, living on saltines and Crisco, and Pa never came home the whole time. By the 8th day, she could circle her foot without stiffness, and the pain had retreated to the surface. She danced a little jig, favoring her foot, squealing, I did it! I did it! The next morning, she headed for the beach to find more pirates.
First thing I'm gonna do is boss my crew to pick up all them nails.
Every morning, she woke early, still listening for the clatter of Ma's busy cooking. Ma's favorite breakfast had been scrambled eggs from her own hens, ripe red tomatoes sliced, and cornbread fritters made by pouring a mixture of cornmeal, water, and salt onto grease so hot the concoction bubbled up, the edges frying into crispy lace. Ma said you weren't really frying something unless you could hear it crackling from the next room. And all her life, Kaya had heard those fritters popping in grease when she woke, smelled the blue, hot corn smoke. But now the kitchen was silent, cold, and Kaya slipped from her porch bed and stole to the lagoon. Months passed, winter easing gently into place, as southern winters do. The sun, warm as a blanket, wrapped Kaya's shoulders, coaxing her deeper into the marsh. Sometimes she heard night sounds she didn't know, or jumped from lightning too close. But whenever she stumbled, it was the land that caught her. Until at last, at some unclaimed moment, the heart pain seeped away like water into sand. Still there, but deep. Kaya laid her hand upon the breathing wet earth, and the marsh became her mother. Chapter 5. Investigation. 1969. Overhead, cicadas squealed against a mean sun. All other life forms cowered from the heat, emitting only a vacant hum from the undergrowth. Wiping his brow, Sheriff Jackson said,
"Vern, there's more to do here, but it doesn't feel right. Chase's wife and folks don't know he's passed." "I'll go tell them, Ed,"
Dr. Vern Murphy replied.
"I appreciate that. Take my truck. Send the ambulance back for Chase and Joe with my truck. But don't speak a word about this to anybody else. I don't want everybody in this town out here, and that's just what'll happen if you mention it."
Before moving, Vern stared for a long minute at Chase, as though he had overlooked something. As a doctor, he should fix this. Heavy swamp air stood behind them, waiting patiently for its turn. Ed turned to the boys.
"Y'all stay right here. I don't need anybody yapping about this in town, and don't put your hands on anything or make any more tracks in the mud."
"Yes, sir," Benji said. "You think somebody killed Chase, don't you? 'Cause there's no footprints. Pushed him off, maybe."
"I didn't say any such thing. This is standard police work. Now you boys just keep out of the way and don't repeat anything you hear out here."
Deputy Joe Perdue, a small man with thick sideburns, showed up in the patrol truck in less than 15 minutes.
"Just can't take it in. Chase dead? He was the best quarterback this town ever saw. This is plumb out of kilter."
"You got that right. Well, let's get to work. What you got so far?"
Ed moved farther from the boys.
"Well, obviously, on the surface, it looks like an accident. He fell from the tower and was killed. But so far, I haven't found any of his footprints walking toward the steps, or prints from anybody else, either. Let's see if we can find any evidence that somebody covered him up."
The two lawmen combed the area for a full 10 minutes.
"You're right. Not one print except for the boys," Joe said. "Yeah, and no signs of somebody brushing them out. I just don't get it. Let's move on. I'll work on this later,"
Ed said. They took pictures of the body, of its position relative to the steps, close-ups of head wounds, the leg bent wrong. Joe made notes as Ed dictated. As they measured the distance from the body to the trail, they heard the sides of the ambulance scratching the thick bushes along the lane. The driver, an old black man who'd taken the wounded, ill, dying, and dead under his charge for decades, bowed his head in respect and whispered suggestions.
"All right, then. His arms ain't going tuck in much, so can't roll him onto the gunny. Have to lift him, and he's going to be heavy. Sheriff, sir, you cradle Mr. Chase's head? That's good. My, my."
By late morning, they'd loaded him, complete with clinging sludge, into the back. Since Dr. Murphy had by now informed Chase's parents of his death, Ed told the boys they could go on home, and he and Joe started up the stairs, which switched to the top, narrowing at each level. As they climbed, the round corners of the world moved out farther and farther, the lush rounded forests and watery marsh expanding to the very rims. When they reached the last step, Jackson lifted his hands and pushed open an iron grate. After they climbed onto the platform, he eased it down again because it was part of the floor. Wooden planks, splintered and grayed with age, formed the center of the platform. But around the perimeter, the floor was a series of see-through square grates that could be opened and closed. As long as they were down, you could walk on them safely. But if one was left open, you could fall to the earth 60 feet below.
"Hey, look at that."
Ed pointed to the far side of the platform, where one of the grates stood open.
"What the hell?"
Joe said as they walked to it, Peering down, they saw the perfect outline of Chase's misshapen form embedded in the mud. Yellowish goo and duckweed had splashed to the sides like a splatter painting.
"This doesn't figure," Ed said. "Some folks forget to close the grate over the stairs, you know, on their way back down. We've found it open a few times, but the others are almost never left open."
"Why would Chase open this one in the first place? Why would anybody?"
"Unless somebody planned to push somebody else to their death," Ed said.
"Then why didn't they close it afterward?"
"Because if Chase had fallen through on his own, he couldn't have closed it. Had to be left open to look like an accident.
Look at that support beam below the hole. It's all bashed in and splintered."
"Yeah, I see. Chase must have banged his head on it when he fell. I climb out there, look for blood or hair samples, collect some splinters. Thanks, Joe. And take some close-ups. I'll go get a rope to spot you. We don't need two bodies in this muck in one day. And we have to take fingerprints off this grate. The grate by the stairs, the railing, the banisters, everything anybody would have touched. And collect any hair samples, threads."
More than 2 hours later, they stretched their backs from the leaning and stooping. Ed said,
"I'm not saying there was foul play. Way too early. But besides that, I can't think of anyone who'd want to kill Chase."
"Well, I'd say there'd be quite a list," the deputy said.
"Like who? What are you talking about?"
"Come on, Ed. You know how Chase was. Tomcatting, rutting round like a penned bull let out. Before he was married, after he was married, with single girls, married women. I seen Randy dogs at a bitch fest better behaved."
"Come on, he wasn't that bad. Sure, he had a reputation as a ladies' man, but I don't see anybody in this town committing murder over it."
"I'm just saying there's people who didn't like him. Some jealous husband. It'd have to be somebody he knew. Somebody we all know. Not likely Chase'd climb up here with some stranger," Joe said.
"Unless he was up to his navel in debt with some out-of-towner. Something like that we didn't know about. And a man strong enough to push Chase Andrews. No small task,"
Joe said. "I can already think of a few guys up to it."
Chapter 6. A Boat and a Boy. 1952. One morning, Pa, shaved fresh and dressed in a wrinkled button-down shirt, came into the kitchen and said he was leaving on the Trailways bus for Asheville to discuss some issues with the Army. He figured he had more disability due him and was off to see about it and wouldn't be back for 3 or 4 days. He'd never told Kaya his business, where he was going or when he was coming back. So standing there in her too short bib overalls, she stared up at him mute.
"I believe you're deaf and dumb as all get out," he said, the porch door slapping behind him.
Kaya watched him gimp along the path, left leg swinging to the side, then forward. Her fingers knotted. Maybe they were all going to leave her one by one down this lane. When he reached the road and unexpectedly looked back, she threw her hand up and waved hard. A shot to keep him tethered. Pa lifted an arm in a quick, dismissive salutation. But it was something. It was more than Ma had done. From there, she wandered to the lagoon, where early light caught the glimmer of hundreds of dragonfly wings. Oaks and thick brush encircled the water, darkening it cave-like. And she stopped as she eyed Pa's boat drifting there on the line. If she took it into the marsh and he found out, he'd take his belt to her. Or the paddle he kept by the porch door. The welcome bat, Jody had called it. Perhaps a yearning to reach out yonder pulled her toward the boat, a bent-up, flat-bottomed metal skiff Pa used for fishing. She'd been out in it all her life, usually with Jody. Sometimes he'd let her steer. She even knew the way through some of the intricate channels and estuaries that wandered through a patchwork of water and land, land and water, finally to the sea. Because even though the ocean was just beyond the trees surrounding the shack, the only way to get there by boat was to go in the opposite direction, inland, and wind through miles of the maze of waterways that eventually hooked back to the sea. But, being only 7 and a girl, she'd never taken the boat out by herself. It floated there, tied by a single cotton line to a log. Gray grunge, frayed fishing tackle, and half-crushed beer cans covered the boat floor. Stepping in, she said out loud, "Gotta check the gas like Jody says so Pa won't figure I took it." She poked a broken reed into the rusted tank. "Not for a short ride, I reckon." Like any good robber, she looked around, then flicked the cotton line free of the log and pulled forward with the lone paddle. The silent cloud of dragonflies parted before her. Not able to resist, she pulled the starter rope and jerked back when the motor caught the first time, sputtering and burping white smoke. Grabbing the tiller, she turned the throttle too far, and the boat turned sharply, the engine screaming. She released the throttle, threw her hands up, and the boat eased to a drift, purring. "When in trouble, just let go. Go back to idle." Accelerating now more gently, she steered around the old fallen cypress, put, 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 beyond the piled sticks of the beaver lodge. Then, holding her breath, she steered toward the lagoon entrance, almost hidden by brambles. Ducking beneath the low-hanging limbs of giant trees, she churned slowly through thicket for more than 100 yards, as easy turtles slid from water logs. A floating mat of duckweed colored the water as green as the leafy ceiling, creating an emerald tunnel. Finally, the trees parted, and she glided into a place of wide sky and reaching grasses and the sounds of cawing birds. The view a chick gets, she reckoned, when it finally breaks its shell. Kaya tooled along, a tiny speck of a girl in a boat, turning this way and that as endless estuaries branched and braided before her. "Keep left at all the turns going out," Jody had said. She barely touched the throttle, easing the boat through the current, keeping the noise low. As she broke around a stand of reeds, a white-tailed doe with last spring's fawn stood lapping water. Their heads jerked up, slinging droplets through the air. Kaya didn't stop or they would bolt. A lesson she'd learned from watching wild turkeys. If you act like a predator, they act like prey. Just ignore them. Keep going slow. She drifted by, and the deer stood as still as a pine until Kaya disappeared beyond the salt grass. She entered a place with dark lagoons and a throat of oaks, and remembered a channel on the far side that flowed to an enormous estuary. Several times she came upon dead ends, had to backtrack to take another turn. Keeping all these landmarks straight in her mind so she could get back. Finally, the estuary lay ahead, water stretching so far it captured the whole sky and all the clouds within it. The tide was going out, she knew by water lines along the creek shores. When it receded enough, any time from now, some channels would shallow up and she'd run aground, get stranded. She'd have to head back before then. As she rounded a stand of tall grass, suddenly the ocean's face, gray, stern, and pulsing, frowned at her. Waves slammed one another, awash in their own white saliva, breaking apart on the shore with loud booms, energy searching for a beachhead. Then they flattened into quiet tongues of foam, waiting for the next surge. The surf taunted her, daring her to breach the waves and enter the sea, but without Jody, her courage failed. Time to turn around anyway. Thunderheads grew in the western sky, forming huge gray mushrooms pressing at the seams. There had been no other people, not even distant boats. So it was a surprise when she entered the large estuary again, and there, close against the marsh grass, was a boy fishing from another battered rig. Her course would take her only 20 feet from him. By now, she looked every bit the swamp child, hair blown into tangles, dusty cheeks streaked with wind tears. Neither low gas nor storm threat gave her the same edgy feeling as seeing another person, especially a boy. Ma had told her older sisters to watch out for them. If you look tempting, men turn into predators. Squishing her lips tight, she thought, "What am I gonna do? I got to go right by him." From the corner of her eye, she saw he was thin, his golden curls stuffed under a red baseball cap. Much older than she, 11, maybe 12. Her face was grim as she approached, but he smiled at her, warm and open, and touched the brim of his hat like a gentleman greeting a fine lady in a gown and bonnet. She nodded slightly, then looked ahead, increasing the throttle and passing him by. All she could think of now was getting back to familiar footing. But somewhere she must have turned wrong, for when she reached the second string of lagoons, she couldn't find the channel that led home. Round and round, near oak knees and myrtle thickets, she searched. A slow panic eased in. Now the grass banks, sandbars, and bends all looked the same. She cut the engine and stood smack dab in the middle of the boat, balancing with feet spread wide, trying to see over the reeds, but couldn't. She sat, lost, low on gas, storm coming. Stealing Pa's words, she cussed her brother for leaving. "Damn you, Jody. Shit fire and fall in. You just shit fire and fall in it." She whispered once as the boat drifted in soft current. Clouds, gaining ground against the sun, moved weighted but silent overhead, pushing the sky and dragging shadows across the clear water. Could be a gale any minute. Worse, though, if she wandered too long, Pa would know she took the boat. She eased ahead. Maybe she could find that boy. Another few minutes of creek brought a bend and the large estuary ahead, and on the other side, the boy in his boat. Egrets took flight, a line of white flags against the morning gray clouds. She anchored him hard with her eyes. Afraid to go near him, afraid not to. Finally, she turned across the estuary. He looked up when she neared.
"Hey,"
he said.
"Hey."
She looked beyond his shoulder into the reeds.
"Which way you headed anyhow?"
he said.
"Not out, I hope. That storm's coming."
"No,"
she said, looking down at the water.
"You okay?"
Her throat tightened against a sob. She nodded, but couldn't speak.
"You lost?"
She bobbed her head again. Wasn't going to cry like a girl.
"Well, then, I get lost all the time," he said, and smiled. "Hey, I know you. You're Jody Clark's sister."
"I used to be. He's gone."
"Well, you're still as..."
But he let it drop.
"How do you know me?"
She threw a quick, direct look at his eyes.
"Oh, I've been fishing with Jody some. I saw you a couple of times. You were just a little kid. You're Kaya, right?"
Someone knew her name. She was taken aback, felt anchored to something, released from something else.
"Yeah?" You know my place? From here?
Reckon I do. It's about time, anyhow. He nodded at the clouds. Follow me.
He pulled his line, put tackle in the box, and started his outboard. As he headed across the estuary, he waved, and she followed. Cruising slowly, he went directly to the right channel, looked back to make sure she'd made the turn, and kept going. He did that at every bend to the Oak Lagoons. As he turned into the dark waterway toward home, she could see where she'd gone wrong, and would never make the mistake again. He guided her, even after she waved that she knew her way, across her lagoon, up to the shore where the shack squatted in the woods. She motored up to the old waterlogged pine and tied up. He drifted back from her boat, bobbing in their contrary wakes.
You okay now?
Yeah.
Well, storm's coming. I better get.
She nodded, then remembered how Ma taught her.
Thank you.
All right, then. My name's Tate, case you see me again.
She didn't respond, so he said,
bye now.
As he headed out, slow raindrops splattered the lagoon beach, and she said,
it's gonna rain bullfrogs. That boy'll get soaked through.
She stooped to the gas tank and stuck in her reed dipstick, cupping her hands around the rim so rain wouldn't drop in. Maybe she couldn't count coins, but she knew for sure you can't let water get in gas.
It's way low. Pa's gonna know. I gotta tote a can to the sing oil before Pa gets back.
She knew the owner, Mr. Johnny Lane. Always referred to her family as swamp trash, but dealing with him, the storms and tides would be worth it, because all she could think of now was getting back into that space of grass and sky and water. Alone, she'd been scared, but that was already humming as excitement.
There was something else, too. The calmness of the boy.
She'd never known anybody to speak or move so steady. So sure and easy. Just being near him, and not even that close, had eased her tightness. For the first time since Ma and Jody left, she breathed without pain, felt something other than the hurt. She needed this boat and that boy. That same afternoon, holding his bike by the handlebars, Tate Walker strolled through town, nodding at Miss Pansy and the Five and Dime, and passed the Western Auto to the tip of the town wharf. He scanned the sea for his dad's shrimp boat, the Cherry Pie, and spotted its bright red paint far out, the wide net wings rocking with the swells. As it neared, escorted by its own cloud of gulls, he waved, and his father, a large man with mountain shoulders and thick red hair and a beard, threw his hand in the air. Scupper, as everyone in the village called him, tossed the line to Tate, who tied up, then jumped on board to help the crew unload the catch. Scupper tousled Tate's hair.
How's it, son? Thanks for coming by.
Tate smiled, nodded. Sure. They and the crew busied about, loading shrimp into crates, toting them to the wharf, calling out to one another about grabbing beers at the doggone, asking Tate about school. Taller by a hand than the other men, Scupper scooped up three wire crates at a time, carrying them across the plank, going back for more. His fists were bear-sized, knuckles chapped and split. In less than 40 minutes, the deck was hosed, nets tied, lines secured. He told the crew he'd join them another day for beer. He had to do some tuning up before going home. In the wheelhouse, Scupper put a 78 record of Mitya Kurius on the player, strapped to the counter, and turned the volume up. He and Tate went below and squeezed into the engine hold, where Tate handed tools to his dad as he greased parts and tightened bolts by a dim light bulb. All the while, the soaring sweet opera lifted higher into the sky. Scupper's great-great-grandfather, emigrating from Scotland, had shipwrecked off the coast of North Carolina in the 1760s and was the only survivor. He swam to shore, landing on the Outer Banks, found a wife, and fathered 13 children. Many could trace their roots back to that one Mr. Walker, but Scupper and Tate stayed mostly to themselves. Didn't join the Sunday picnic spreads of chicken salad and deviled eggs with their relatives often. Not like they had when his mother and sister were still there. Finally, in the graying dusk, Scupper slapped Tate on the shoulders.
All done. Let's get home, get supper on.
They walked up the wharf, down Main and out a winding road to their house, a two-story with weathered cedar-shake siding, built in the 1800s. The white window trim had been painted fresh, and the lawn running almost to the sea was cut neat. But the azaleas and rose bushes next to the house sulked in weeds. Pulling off yellow boots in the mudroom, Scupper asked,
"You tired of burgers?"
"Never tired of burgers."
Tate stood at the kitchen counter, picking up globs of hamburger meat, forming patties, and placing them on a plate. His mother and sister, Carrie Ann, both wearing baseball caps, grinned at him from a picture hanging next to the window. Carrie Ann loved that Atlanta Crackers cap, had worn it everywhere. He looked away from them, started slicing tomatoes, stirring baked beans. If not for him, they'd be here. His mother basting a chicken, Carrie Ann cutting biscuits. As usual, Scupper got the burgers a bit black, but they were juicy inside and thick as a small city phone book. Both hungry, they ate in silence for a while. And then Scupper asked Tate about school.
"Biology's good. I like it, but we're doing poetry in English class. Can't say I like it much. We each got to read one out loud. You used to recite some, but I don't remember them." "I got the poem for you, son," Scupper said. "My favorite. The Cremation of Sam McGee by Robert Service. Used to read it out to y'all. Was your mama's favorite. She laughed every time I read it. Never got tired of it."
Tate looked down at the mention of his mother, pushed his beans around. Scupper went on.
"Don't go thinking poetry's just for sissies. There's mushy love poems, for sure, but there's also funny ones. Lots about nature, war even. Whole point of it? They make you feel something."
His dad had told him many times that the definition of a real man is one who cries without shame, reads poetry with his heart, feels opera in his soul, and does what's necessary to defend a woman. Scupper walked to the sitting room, calling back,
"I used to know most of it by heart, but not anymore. But here it is. I'll read it to you."
He sat back down at the table and began reading. When he got to this segment,
"And there sat Sam, looking cool and calm in the heart of the furnace roar. And he wore a smile you could see a mile, and he said, 'Please close that door. It's fine in here, but I greatly fear you'll let in the cold and storm. Since I left Plumtree down in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been warm.'"
Scupper and Tate chuckled.
"Your mom always laughed at that."
They smiled, remembering. Just sat there a minute. Then Scupper said he'd wash up while Tate did his homework. In his room, scanning through the poetry book for one to read in class, Tate found a poem by Thomas Moore. "She's gone to the lake of the dismal swamp, where all night long by a firefly lamp, she paddles her white canoe. And her firefly lamp I soon shall see, and her paddle I soon shall hear. Long and loving our life shall be, and I'll hide the maid in a cypress tree when the footstep of death is near." The words made him think of Kaya, Jody's little sister. She'd seemed so small and alone in the marsh's big sweep. He imagined his own sister lost out there. His dad was right. Poems made you feel something. Chapter 7. The Fishing Season. 1952. That evening, after the fishing boy led her home through the marsh, Kaya sat cross-legged on her porch bed. Mist from the downpour eased through the patched-up screen, touching her face. She thought about the boy. Kind yet strong, like Jody. The only people she ever spoke to were Pa now and then, and even less often the cash register lady at the Piggly Wiggly, Mrs. Singletary, who had recently taken to teaching Kaya the difference between quarters, nickels, and dimes. She already knew about pennies. But Mrs. Singletary could also get nosy.
"Darling, what's your name, anyhow? And why don't your ma come in any more? Haven't seen her since the turnips put out."
"Ma's got lots of chores, so she sends me to the store."
"Yeah, dear, but you never buys near enough for your family."
"You know, ma'am, I got to go. Ma needs these grits right away."
When possible, Kaya avoided Mrs. Singletary, using the other checkout lady, who didn't show any interest except to say kids shouldn't come to the market barefoot. She thought of telling the lady she didn't plan to pick grapes with her toes. Who could afford grapes anyhow? More and more, Kaya didn't talk to anybody but the gulls. She wondered if she could strike some bargain with Pa to use his boat. Out in the marsh, she could collect feathers and shells, and maybe see the boy sometimes. She'd never had a friend, but she could feel the use of it. The pull. They could boat around in the estuaries some, explore the fens. He might think of her as a little kid, but he knew his way around the marsh and might teach her. Pa didn't have a car. He used the boat to fish, to go to town, to maneuver through the swamp to the Swamp Guinea, a weathered bar and poker joint connected to solid ground by a rickety boardwalk through cattails. Made of rough-cut clapboard under a tin roof, it rambled from one add-on to the next, the floor at different levels depending on how high the brick chicken legs perched it above the swamp. When Pa went there or anywhere, he took the boat. Only rarely walked. So why would he lend it to her? But he'd let her brothers use it when he wasn't. Probably because they caught fish for supper. She had no interest in fishing. But maybe she could trade something else. Figuring that was the way to reach him. Cook, maybe. Do more around the house. Until Ma came back. The rain eased. A single drop here, then there, shook a leaf like the flick of a cat's ear. Kaya hopped up, cleaned out the Frigidaire cupboard, mopped the stained plywood kitchen floor, and scraped off months of caked-on grits from the wood stove burners. Early the next morning, she scrubbed Pa's sheets, reeking of sweat and whiskey, and draped them over the palmettos. She went through her brother's room, not much bigger than a closet, dusting and sweeping. Dirty socks were piled in the back of the closet and yellowed comic books strewn next to the two soiled mattresses on the floor. She tried to see the boys' faces, the feet that went with the socks, but the details blurred. Even Jody's face was fading. She'd see his eyes for an instant, then they'd slip away, closing. The next morning, carrying a gallon can, she walked the sandy tracks to the Piggly and bought matches, backbone, and salt. Saved out 2 dimes.
"Can't get milk. Got to get gas."
She stopped by the Sing Oil filling station just outside Barkley Cove, which stood in a grove of pines surrounded by rusted-out trucks and jalopy cars stacked on cement blocks. Mr. Lane saw Kaya coming.
"Get on out of here, you little beggar hant. Marsh trash."
"I got cash money, Mr. Lane. I need gas and oil for Pa's boat motor.
She held out 2 dimes, 2 nickels, and 5 pennies.
Well, ain't hardly worth my trouble for such a piddly sum, but come on, give it here.
He reached for the bent-up square container. She thanked Mr. Lane, who grunted again. The groceries and gas weighed more with every mile, and it took some time to get home. Finally, in the shade of the lagoon, she emptied the can into the gas tank and scrubbed the boat with rags and wet sand for grist until the metal sides showed through the grime. On the 4th day after Pa left, she started keeping a lookout. By late afternoon, a cold dread set in and her breathing shallowed up. Here she was again, staring down the lane.
Mean as he was, she needed him to come back.
Finally, in the early evening, there he came, walking the sandy ruts. She ran to the kitchen and laid out a goulash of boiled mustard greens, backbone, and grits. She didn't know how to make gravy, so poured the backbone stock, floating with morsels of white fat, into an empty jelly jar. The plates were cracked and didn't match, but she had the fork on the left, the knife on the right, like Ma taught her. Then she waited, flattened up against the Frigidaire like a roadkill stork. He banged the front door open against the wall and walked through the sitting room to his bedroom in 3 strides without calling her or looking in the kitchen. That was normal. She heard him putting his case on the floor, pulling out drawers. He'd noticed the fresh bedding, the clean floor for sure. If not, his eyes, his nose would catch the difference. In a few minutes, he stepped out, straight into the kitchen, and looked at the set table, at the steaming bowls of food. He saw her standing against the fridge, and they stared at each other like they'd never seen each other before.
"A Swanee, girl, what's of this? Looks like you went and got all growed up, cooking and all."
He didn't smile, but his face was calm. He was unshaven, with dark, unwashed hair hanging across his left temple. But he was sober. She knew the signs.
"Yes, sir. I fixed cornbread, too, but it didn't come out."
"Well, I thank ye. That's a mighty good girl. I'm plumb wore out and hungry as a wallow hog."
He pulled out a chair and sat, so she did the same. In silence, they filled their plates and picked stringy meat from the stingy backbones. He lifted a vertebra and sucked out the marrow, fatty juice glistening on his whiskered cheeks. Gnawed on those bones till they were slick as silk ribbons.
"This here is better than a cold collard sandwich," he said.
"I wish the cornbread had come out. Maybe should have put more soda in. Less eggs."
Kaya couldn't believe she was talking on so, but couldn't stop herself.
"Ma made it so good, but I guess I didn't pay enough mind to the details."
Then thought she shouldn't be talking about Ma, so hushed up. Pa pushed his plate toward her.
"Enough for a dab more?"
"Yes, sir. There's a plenty."
"Oh, and tump some of that cornbread right in the stew. I got a hankering for sopping up the stock. And my bet is that bread's just fine, mushy like spoon bread."
She smiled to herself as she filled his plate. Who would have thought they'd find cornbread as a footing? But now, after thinking about it, she worried that if she asked to use the boat, he would think she'd cooked and cleaned only for the favor, which was how it started out, but now seemed somehow different. She liked sitting down and eating like a family. Her need to talk to somebody felt urgent. So she didn't mention using the boat by herself. Instead asked,
"Can I go out fishing with you sometime?"
He laughed hard, but it was kind. The first time he'd laughed since Ma and the others left.
"So you want to go fishing?"
"Yes, sir, I do."
"You're a girl,"
he said, looking at his plate, chewing backbone.
"Yes, sir. I'm your girl."
"Well, I might could take you out sometime.
The next morning, as Kaya careened down the sandy lane, her arms held straight out, she sputtered wet noises from her lips, spittle spraying. She would lift off and sail over the marsh, looking for nests, then rise and fly wing to wing with eagles. Her fingers became long feathers, splayed against the sky, gathering the wind beneath her. Then suddenly she was jerked back to earth by Pa hollering to her from the boat. Her wings collapsed, stomach pitched. He must have figured out she'd used it. She could already feel the paddle on her bottom and the backs of her legs. She knew how to hide, wait until he was drunk and he'd never find her. But she was too far down the lane in full view, and there he was, standing with all his poles and rods, motioning for her to come. She walked over, quiet, scared. The fishing tackle was strewn about, a poke of corn liquor tucked under his seat.
"Get in,"
was all he said, his invitation. She started to express glee or gratitude, but his blank expression kept her quiet as she stepped to the bow and sat on the metal seat facing forward. He pull-cranked and they headed up the channel, ducking the overgrowth as they cruised up and down the waterways, Kaya memorizing broken trees and old stump signposts. He eased the motor down in a backwater and motioned for her to sit on the center seat.
"Go on now, scratch some worms from the can," he said, a hand-rolled cigarette hanging at the corner of his mouth.
He taught her to snag the bait, to cast and reel. It seemed he contorted his body in odd postures to avoid brushing against her. They only talked fishing, never ventured to other subjects, neither smiled often, but on common ground they were steady. He drank some liquor, but then got busy and didn't drink more. At late day, the sun sighed, fading to the color of butter, and they may not have noticed, but their own shoulders finally rounded and their necks slacked. Secretly, Kaya hoped not to catch a fish, but she felt a tug, jerked her line, and raised a thick bream, flashing silver and blue. Pa leaned out and snatched it in the net, then sat back, slapping his knee and yahooing like she'd never seen. She grinned wide, and they looked into each other's eyes, closing a circuit. Before Pa strung it up, the bream flopped around in the boat bottom, and Kaya had to watch a distant string of pelicans, study the cloud forms, anything but look into dying fish eyes staring at a world without water, wide mouth sucking worthless air. But what it cost her and what it cost that fish was worth it to have this little shred of family. Perhaps not for the fish, but still. They went out in the boat again the next day, and in a dark lagoon, Kaya spotted the soft breast feathers of a great horned owl floating on the surface. Each curled at both ends, so that they drifted around like tiny orange boats. She scooped them up and put them in her pocket. Later, she found an abandoned hummingbird nest woven onto an outstretched branch and tucked it safely in the bow. That evening, Pa cooked up a supper of fried fish, coated in cornmeal and black pepper, served with grits and greens. As Kaya washed up after, Pa walked into the kitchen, carrying his old World War II issue knapsack. Standing near the door, he flung it roughly onto one of the chairs. It slid to the floor with a thud, which made her jump and whirl around.
"Thought you could use that for your feathers, birds' nests, and all that other stuff you collect."
"Oh," Kaya said. "Oh, thank you." But he was already out the porch door. She picked up the frayed knapsack, made of canvas tough enough for a lifetime, and covered in small pockets and secret compartments, heavy-duty zips. She stared out the window. He had never given her anything. Every warmish day of winter and every day of spring, Pa and Kaya went out, far up and down the coast, trolling, casting, and reeling. Whether in estuary or creek, she scanned for that boy Tate in his boat, hoping to see him again. She thought about him sometimes, wanted to be his friend, but had no idea how to go about it or even how to find him. Then, just like that, one afternoon she and Pa came around a bend, and there he was, fishing, almost in that same spot where she first saw him. Right off, he grinned and waved. Without thinking, she threw her hand up and waved back, almost smiling, then dropped her hand just as quick when Pa looked at her surprised.
"One of Jody's friends before he left," she said.
"You got to watch out for folks round here," he said. "Woods are full of white trash. Pert near everybody out here is a no count."
She nodded, wanted to look back at the boy, but didn't, then worried he would think her unfriendly. Pa knew the marsh the way a hawk knows his meadow. How to hunt, how to hide, how to terrorize intruders. And Kaya's wide-eyed questions spurred him to explain goose seasons, fish habits, how to read weather in the clouds and riptides in the waves. Some days, she packed a picnic supper in the knapsack and they ate crumbly cornbread, which she had almost mastered, with sliced onions as the setting sun posed over the marsh. Occasionally, he forgot the bootleg and they drank tea from jelly jars.
"My folks weren't always Pa, you know,"
Pa blurted out one day as they sat in oak shadows, casting lines across a brown lagoon buzzing with low-flying insects.
"They had land, rich land, raised tobacco and cotton and such. Over near Asheville, your grandma on my side wore bonnets big as wagon wheels and long skirts. We lived in a house with a veranda that went all the way around, two stories high. It was fine, mighty fine."
"A grandma."
Kaya's lips parted. Somewhere there was, or had been, a grandmother. Where was she now? Kaya longed to ask what happened to everybody, but was afraid. Pa continued on his own.
"Then it all went wrong together. I was a young'un through most of it, so don't know, but there was the depression, cotton weevils, I don't know what all, and it was gone. Only thing left was debts. Lots of debts."
With these sketchy details, Kaya struggled to visualize his past. There was nothing of Ma's history. Pa would go into a rage if any of them talked about their lives before Kaya was born. She knew her family had lived somewhere far away before the marsh, near her other grandparents, a place where Ma wore store-bought dresses with small pearly buttons, satin ribbons, and lace trim. After they moved into the shack, Ma kept the dresses in trunks, taking one out every few years and stripping it down for a work smock because there was no money for anything new. Now those fine clothes, along with their story, were gone, burned in the bonfire Pa started after Jody left. Kaya and Pa cast some more, their lines swishing over soft yellow pollen floating on the still water. And she thought that was the end of it, but he added,
"Someday I'll take you to Asheville, show you the land that was ourn, should have been yourn."
After a bit, he jerked his line.
"Looky here, hon, I got us a big un, big as Alabama."
Back in the shack, they fried the fish and hush puppies, fat as goose eggs. Then she displayed her collections, carefully pinning the insects to pieces of cardboard and the feathers to the wall of the back bedroom in a soft, stirring collage. Later, she lay in her bed on the porch listening to the pines. She closed her eyes and then opened them wide. He had called her Hun. Chapter 8. Negative Data. 1969. After finishing their morning's investigative work at the fire tower, Sheriff Ed Jackson and Deputy Joe Perdue escorted Chase's widow, Pearl, and his parents, Patty Love and Sam, to see him lying on a steel table under a sheet in a chilled lab at the clinic, which served as a morgue, to say goodbye. But it was too cold for any mother, unbearable for any wife. Both women had to be helped from the room. Back at the sheriff's office, Joe said,
"Well, that was as bad as it gets."
"Yeah, don't know how anybody gets through it."
Sam didn't say a word. He never was a talker, but this'll do him in.
Saltwater marsh, some say, can eat a cement block for breakfast, and not even the sheriff's bunker-style office could keep it at bay. Watermarks outlined with salt crystals waved across the lower walls, and black mildew spread like blood vessels toward the ceiling. Tiny dark mushrooms hunkered in the corners. The sheriff pulled a bottle from the bottom drawer of his desk and poured them both a double in coffee mugs. They sipped until the sun, as golden and syrupy as the bourbon, slipped into the sea. 4 days later, Joe, waving documents in the air, entered the sheriff's office.
"I got the first of the lab reports. Let's have a look."
They sat on opposite sides of the sheriff's desk, scanning. Joe, now and then, swatted at a single housefly. Ed read out loud.
"Time of death between midnight and 2 a.m., October 29th to 30th, 1969. Just what we thought."
After a minute of reading, he continued.
"What we have is negative data."
"You got that right. There ain't a thing here, Sheriff.
Except for the two boys going up to the third switchback, there are no fresh fingerprints on the railing, the grates, nothing. None from Chase or anybody else."
Afternoon whiskers shadowed the sheriff's otherwise ruddy complexion.
"So somebody wiped him clean. Everything. If nothing else, why aren't his fingerprints on the railing, the grate?"
"Exactly.
First we had no footprints, now no fingerprints. There's no evidence at all that he walked across the mud to the steps, walked up the steps, or opened the two grates at the top, the one above the stairs and the one he fell through. Or that anybody else did either. But negative data's still data. Somebody cleaned up real good, or killed him somewhere else and moved his body to the tower.
But if his body was hauled to the tower, there'd be tire tracks."
"Right. We need to go back out there. Look for tread marks besides ours and the ambulance. May have overlooked something."
After a minute more of reading, Ed said,
"Anyway, I'm confident now this was no accident."
Joe said,
"I agree, and not just anybody can wipe up tracks this good." "I'm hungry. Let's go by the diner on the way out there."
"Well, get ready for an ambush. Everybody in town's pretty riled up. Chase Andrews's murder's the biggest thing's happened round here maybe ever. Gossip's going up like smoke signals."
"Well, keep an ear out. We might pick up a tidbit or two. Most ne'er-do-wells can't keep their mouths shut."
A full bank of windows, framed by hurricane shutters, covered the front of the Barclay Cove Diner, which overlooked the harbor. Only the narrow street stood between the building, constructed in 1889, and the soggy steps of the village pier. Discarded shrimp baskets and wadded-up fishing nets lined the wall under the windows, and here and there, mollusk shells littered the sidewalk. Everywhere, seabird cries, seabird dung. The aroma of sausage and biscuits, boiled turnip greens, and fried chicken thankfully overtook the high smell of fish barrels lining the dock. A mild bustle spilled out when the sheriff opened the door. Every booth, high-backed with red padded upholstery, was taken, as were most of the tables. Joe pointed to two empty stools at the soda fountain counter, and the two walked toward them. On the way, they